This morning, we welcome Ben Hicks as our speaker. Ben Hicks has worked in information technology industry for 16 years. He's an advocate for collaborative practice and open source software. He's a member of the Nashville Linux Users Group and serves as the secretary of Nashville 2600. Ben obtained an associate's degree in theology from Beacon University and has a strong interest in the areas of communication and effective meditation. The title of Ben's sermon is Keep Calm and Be Uncertain, A Look at Cognitive Bias. Let's welcome Ben.
Okay. All right. Round five or six for me, I think. So I'm going to try not to read too much, but I have a lot to go through, and I didn't really go through a dry run of this, so I may have to skip some stuff if I get too much. Our brains are good at fooling us. Our feelings, our memories, the way we think obviously helps us survive, but at the same time misleads us in a lot of ways. The purpose of my talk today is to cover a few brief examples of this and to remind us, if we have forgotten, or educate us, if we don't know, that we can't really trust ourselves to make good and rational decisions without accounting for failings. The problem of this is what I think of as a car. Has anybody here ever had a car out of alignment? You know, so like it turns when you're going down the highway, it keeps turning, so you have to hold the steering wheel this way to make it go straight. I think about that when I think about cognitive bias in our brain, because our brain and the way we think tends to go a certain way, and if we can compensate by thinking about it, we just keep that steering wheel, you know. So before I get further into this, I have a lot of sources, and there is kind of a cognitive problem with that, which I'll talk about later. A lot of my sources are from Wikipedia, also from a really great course. It's called The Great Course, if you guys know of The Great Courses. It's called Our Deceptive Mind, A Scientific Guide to Critical Thinking Skills, and it's by an academic neurologist at the Yale School of Medicine named Steve Novella. So great course, 10 hours on the audio. Fantastic listen. I listened to it like three times. All right. So in 1917, two cousins, a 16-year-old and a 9-year-old in Cottingley, England, decided to have some fun with their father's camera and their artistic skills. They used hat pins and papers and cutouts to create a picture of, to create a series of five pictures with them interacting with fairies, telling their parents that the fairies would only appear to them near a brook that they played at. Their father was skeptical, knowing their artistic skills, but their mother believed and shared the photos with some friends and eventually to the wider public, and many believed. It wasn't until the 1980s, well over 50 years later, did the girls admit that they had created the photographs with paper and drawings. Now, disclaimer here, I'm not saying that fairies don't exist. I'm just saying that this story, it was made up. People wanted to believe it. The mass public wants to believe in stories, right? So, now this is not unusual. We've had the air taken out of the balloon for many mysterious photos and stories over the recent years. Recently, the grandson of the photographer of the famous Loch Ness photo admitted to creating the beast that the picture was taken of, and crop circles turned out to be some practical joking farmers, and the most widely used film evidence for claiming that there's a Bigfoot turned out to be a friend of the filmer who wore a suit. People maintained their secrets for years, but after enough time, they seemed to want to come forward and tell the truth about how they hoodwinked everyone. Honestly, what interested me most about the pictures of the Cottingley fairies, and you can Wikipedia that, by the way, and look it up yourself if you're interested, was Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's belief in the photographs. He was a physician and author and the famous creator of the best-known detective in literature, Sherlock Holmes. To my mind, I wondered how the man behind Sherlock could not be extra careful about evidence and the sources of where it came from. Doyle was a spiritualist and desperately wanted evidence that his beliefs were accurate, even to the point of ignoring the simplest explanation for the photos. And Doyle is not alone in his desire. It turns out that every one of us has an innate tendency to confirm our beliefs. It's called confirmation bias. So here's my disclaimer again. I'm not picking on anyone, not saying that there's no Bigfoot or Loch Ness or fairies, just that the stories that we believe are often hoaxes and we fall for them. Wikipedia says that a confirmation bias is the tendency to search for, interpret, favor, and recall information in a way that confirms one's beliefs or hypothesis while giving disproportionately less consideration to alternative possibilities. In other words, we only care about information that reinforces what we think, and we ignore what other options there are. As an example of a confirmation bias is called the toupee fallacy. Some people believe that they can always tell when a man is wearing a toupee because when they notice. But if you take in their confirmation of their, they take it as a confirmation of their ability. However, they're not accounting for the fact that they don't notice when they don't recognize a toupee. The data is completely missing from their data set. Another example of this is that wild dolphins are friendly. There's all these stories about, you know, people shipwrecking or whatever, and these wild dolphins swim up and push them back into land because they're so friendly. But what we don't know are how many wild dolphins pushed them further out to sea, and they didn't live to tell us. So we can't really say for certain that all dolphins are friendly. Maybe they just got the nice guy in the neighborhood, you know? So a confirmation bias is one of the most persuasive pervasive biases in our thinking, and is an important one to understand thoroughly. Another example is consider interpreting a scientific study. If the conclusion of the study is something that we agree with, we accept it as a good, solid study. But if the conclusion of the study is something we disagree with, we're going to look much more carefully at the potential flaws in the study and try to find some way to dismiss the conclusion. Research shows that we expend a great deal of time and effort trying to find reasons to rationalize the data. Another bias closely related to the confirmation bias is called a congruence bias. A congruence bias is a tendency to test our own theories about things but not test alternative theories. We try and figure out how something works and make theories on it and don't test against our theories. And a good example of this that I was reading about was they took some people, brought them into a lab in a university, and they said, here's an example number sequence 2, 4, 6, 8, 10. And here's like a computer test and try to find out the logic example behind what's making those, or what the rule is for this number set. Like we've all done SATs and ACTs, same thing. And so people quickly decided that, oh, it's numbers incrementing by 2. And they never thought to try numbers incrementing by 1 or numbers non-incrementing. And what it was that the researchers were looking for was that just that numbers incremented. They didn't care how far you skipped, what the numbers were or anything. They were looking for people to find that logical rule, and nobody could really find it because they just accepted their own belief and didn't try to fight against it or didn't try to test against it. In order to avoid this, we need to construct observations that are designed to test multiple ideas, not just our own. This tendency leads people to hold conclusions that may have no statistical basis in reality. And that's fun because moving on, there's another way our brains lie to us, and that's math. We're really good at small numbers. We're not so good at big numbers. Does anybody play the Powerball? Yeah. So at work, they came around. There's a big pool. They come around, and do you want to play the Powerball? And I always put in a dollar because, like, I just – if everybody retires from work when they win, I just want to be – have enough money to go find another job. You know, I don't want to be there if all my coworkers leave. So I put in like a dollar or two every time. I hedge my bets, and I've lost it every time, of course. So, but we're really bad at numbers. And the fallacy, it's called the lottery fallacy. I'll get to that in a second. So humans are terrible at probability. Our brains are very good at certain tasks, such as pattern recognition, but we have a horrible innate sense of probability. We especially have difficulty dealing with large numbers. We appear to have evolved an intuitive sense of small numbers, but only deal with large numbers in the abstract language of mathematics. This innumeracy, or failure to appreciate statistics, leads to a number of cognitive bias. For example, when we notice a coincidence, the two events seem to have a connection with each other, and we see coincidences as highly improbable. But just like the lottery, the question shouldn't be asked of is, how likely is it for me to win the lottery, but how likely is it for someone to win the lottery, which is going to happen almost every time the lottery is played. And then we see the news reports and all that, and we think, oh, it could happen to me, and it could, but really slightly. The odds of a special person winning the lottery may be very low, but that does not mean that the event is unlikely to have occurred by chance alone, because the probability of anyone winning is very high. There's something else that's really interesting. Has anybody ever heard of the Sports Illustrated cover curse? So every time Sports Illustrated features some athlete on their cover, the next year that athlete doesn't do as well. That's supposedly the thing. Well, this is a a common fallacy. It's called regression to the mean in statistics, where if a person has a really great year, next year, statistically, they're probably going to go back to the average. And so there's this idea that this curse has come up by Sports Illustrated. So whenever they feature some great athlete, the next year they don't do so well. And so it's that idea. But really, they're just playing their normal year probably the next year, or they're lower than normal, and then they'll average all out. Really bad at that. The other thing is gambler's fallacy. We all know that, like, if you flip a coin 10 times and you get heads every time, what's the likelihood that you're going to get tails the 11th time? It's still 50-50. It doesn't change. And we know that intuitively, but when we look at life, we still look at it wrong. Another interesting aspect with math is cold reading. And this is a technique that they used to use in circuses and even on some TV shows now, where they throw out like big things, like I'm thinking of a number of letters, or I'm thinking of someone who has a family that does this and, or that, and they throw out vague and high probability guesses, and people answer back and believe that they're being spoken with by dead loved ones and other things like that. The last area I'm gonna mention is memory. And this one, it starts to kind of get tragic, because everything we think and experience becomes a memory, which is further constructed and altered and fused. We rely upon our memories as if they were accurate recordings of the past, but the evidence shows that we should be highly suspicious of even the most vivid and confident memories. We don't recall memories as much as we reconstruct them. And the best analogy that I've seen about memory is think of a Wikipedia article. Because if you go to a Wikipedia article, there's tons of people that go in and they edit, and then something new happens, they go in and edit, and there's more sources. And our memories work exactly the same way. When we recall something from the past, our current emotional feeling, we'll edit it, we'll think about it differently. Every time we recall that memory, we alter it slightly. I don't know about you, but one of the best examples I could think of for this was, how many have read the Harry Potter series? So I've read the 7 books. Each time a new book came out, I would reread the whole thing. So I've read it a bunch of times. And I've seen the movies. And now whenever I think of something, the actors' faces are in the, I can't remember whether it was in the movie or it was in the book, because they just blended together in my head, which is another scary thing. And that's kind of what I talked about earlier. It's called source amnesia. And this happens to me all the time when I'm telling somebody a story. I'm like, I'm trying to remember where I heard that from, and I can't remember where it came from, whether I read it in a book or on YouTube or something. And the other problem with source amnesia is it's truth amnesia as well. We forget, I'm jumping ahead, but we'll forget how true something is. And it's really, really sensitive to people who do myth busting, like for vaccines. The story went out, you know, that vaccines are not bad for people. And just by saying that, people remember, oh, I have a negative feeling about vaccines. What is it again? Oh, I better not get them. So even the people trying to tell the truth that vaccines are good, the people are remembering, oh, there was something about vaccines again. I'm just not going to go there, you know? And so we have this negative affectation just by remembering that there was something bad about that topic, but I don't remember what it was. An example that just popped in my head just now is Chipotle, right? The story went out that they had a some kind of sickness that went through it. And then I don't remember. I didn't look up the details, but right now I don't want to eat at Chipotle. You know, so it's like it may have only been one area. It may, you know, it's so, again, all these views are mine, not the church's, not anybody else's. So don't, yeah. But anyway, we confabulate, we put things in gaps, we just remember a feeling that we had about a certain topic, and we don't remember the details. Let me see here. Human memory is utterly flawed. Like perceptions, memory is not a passive recording. Instead, our memories are constructed entirely by our brains. In fact, they're tied together with everything that we think and believe in our internal model of reality. When you think about a memory, I guess the best example is to think about a Wikipedia page, like I was saying, different sources that are constantly being updated. There's a false assumption that all problems with our memory are associated with recall. Some memories never form. In other words, we never experiencing something having moved from short-term to long-term memory. Memories also degrade and change over time. There was a really interesting study where two researchers asked students the day after September 11th what they were doing during the bombings. And you know, the students wrote down their answer. It was highly accurate. Then they went back and asked them at intervals over time. And despite how confident they were about what they were doing, their memories had changed. Even though I can remember, I think I remember what I was doing on September 11th. But when I think about it now, I'm like, wait a minute. I was supposed to be at work by then. How could I have been at home watching the TV? So but this idea that memories change over time, and we get very confident in them. And just because we're confident in the memory doesn't mean that it's still accurate. By the way, a memory that you make due to a huge emotional event like September 11th or something you witness is called a flashbulb memory. It's very vivid. You think you can recall it very clearly, but that's the problem. You think you can recall it very clearly. Interestingly, a confidence in memory is not a good predictor of the accuracy of a memory. We tend to naively assume that if we are very confident in a memory, it feels vivid to us and it can be easily recalled, it must be accurate. But the research does not support this. The next thing is a huge problem for me, and I mentioned it earlier. Source amnesia is the example of a disconnect between accuracy and confidence. We don't remember where we learned things from. Even when we recall the information itself, our brains don't care about the source information. The truth status appears to fade faster than familiarity, as does source status. Therefore, familiarity leads us to believe that the things that we think are true and what gets reinforced with repetition. The effect of not remembering the truth status of a claim is worsened when the truth status is not revealed until the end. This has many implications for information campaigns that involve myth busting. So just trying to tell people, no, that's not true, is going to flip a switch in your head where you, I don't know about that now. There's people, what's much worse than not having a good memory for details is the fact that we actually alter the details. We construct a narrative which has emotions and themes tied to it, and we alter details in order to be in line with our thematic narrative. Therefore, details are also biased thematically. Memory contamination occurs when details that are introduced after an event are incorporated into the memory of the event itself. In this way, past events become contaminated. Memory contamination occurs when we incorporate details that we are exposed to. The language is too high, sorry. Mm-hmm. When I write, I get very, These are false memories that are constructed by someone asking a leading question, like, how fast were you going when you slammed into that car, implying that you were speeding? And just by asking a question like that, people will answer an average of 10 miles more than what they were actually going just by using the word slam in the question. And we see this all the time in the political polls where they ask questions like, do you care about the poor people? You know, stuff like that, that's automatically going to bias the answer, and they take those answers and make claims about them. What was it, Roger? 82.5% of statistics are made up? Yeah. That was made up. Additionally, we tend to invent details to fill in the gaps in order to create a consistent story and reinforce our emotional themes. Forced confabulation occurs when leading questions are asked about something that was viewed, for example. In studies of forced confabulation, subjects can remember seeing a non-existent scene. And this is really scary. There's a really good TED Talk on this by, and I wrote her name down here, Elizabeth Loftus. And in the TED Talk, she talks about how they were able to induce memories in children that had never had them. And one of the memories they induced, and this happened, I think it happened to me as a kid, I don't know. But one of the memories they induced was being lost in the grocery store and being unable to find your parents. And that's such a powerful, I remember that happening to me, and I think it really did. But they talk about how that just by having people talk about it and describe it or imagine it, within a few weeks, they automatically assume it's part of their narrative. They automatically, since they imagine themselves doing it, the other thing is dreams. When we dream that we've done something, and sometimes I wonder about this, did I dream that I told that person that? Did I really say that? I can't remember. You know, because our narratives, our stories are all constructed from all these sources. And if you're like me and you're a big reader and you're reading fiction all the time and stories all the time, it's like, wait a minute, did I do that or say that? Or is that part of me? Or is that from outside? We have a really hard time with that. The ability to confabulate can lead to what was called false memories. And this is a really tragic example. In 1998, Ellen Bass and Laura Davis wrote a book called The Courage to Heal, in which they promoted the idea that many people, mostly women, were abused as children, and that they felt that these memories of these highly traumatic events were repressed and later manifested as adults as anxiety or depression or eating disorders and other problems. Bass and Davis created an epidemic of what is now known as false memory syndrome. Therapists who follow their prescription encourage clients to remember details of abuse, which led to many thousands of people actually manufacturing memories of intense abuse as children and believing that they were real. And there were cases of like parents going to prison. There was another interesting, and I think it was from the same time, people that believed in Satanism. I don't know if you remember the 80s where this big Satanism scare came. And I imagine it was particularly real for pagans because you got picked on for, oh, you believe in the devil, all that kind of crazy stuff. But people had kept remembering in the past of they were part of these satanic rituals and all this stuff. And a lot of it was leading questions being asked by a therapist, or in some cases when they were under hypnosis, when they're highly suggestive and you ask a question, they construct a memory or they imagine these things happening and then they really believe it. And the scary part is these people, it's real. They're not lying. They really believe these stories. They really believe that they were tortured. They really believe that they witnessed this thing. And they've imagined it in their head and they have the same trauma. In this one of the examples that Elizabeth, I can't remember, Lofton, gave was that she could influence people's behavior by planting false memories. Like say, when you ate pizza, you got really sick that one time, don't you remember? And you threw up all over and describe all this stuff. And then the next time when people were presented with that food, they would go, ooh, wait, I don't want to eat that because it made me sick. So that it's a possibility, I may be running out of time here. It's a possibility that those kind of things can happen. I'm going to skip forward. I think I'm almost out of time, guys. Sorry. In addition to false memories, false experiences are very easy to generate. In one study, participants read an advertisement for a new and false brand of popcorn that vividly described both the taste and the feel of the popcorn. And a week later, participants were asked whether they were actually given the popcorn to taste or whether it was just described to them. And a certain percentage of the people who were never exposed to the popcorn remember having eaten it. In other words, they inserted themselves into the memory of an event they had only read about. This is a caution for any profession that must solicit a history from another person, such as police officers or physicians and therapists. People in these professions need to remember the incredible tendency for suggestibility in creating false memories. Furthermore, not only do we need to avoid encouraging people to invent memories, but we also need to make sure that there's always some external objective verification. Courts, in fact, have been using more caution about the validity of eyewitness testimony in recognition of the needs to validate any testimony with some kind of objective evidence. Have any of you watched the How to Make a Murder on Netflix? You know what I'm talking about? Yeah, I watched it. And it kind of just set me on this, what? How could this be real? And reading everything. And it was slanted. It was very slanted, I found out later. But nevertheless, it brings up a lot of good points. I did a copy and paste of a couple little paragraphs from a few articles. And I just wanted to read about, even thinking about juries and thinking about eyewitness testimony. If you remember, well, those of you who haven't watched it, it's very interesting. It's a Netflix documentary. And it's about a man named Stephen Avery. And he was accused of rape. Even though he had collaborating evidence that he was not there at the time and all this stuff, he was accused of rape. And then the actual lady who was raped saw him in a police lineup, was even suggested that this was him by a picture. And then she suddenly believed it was him beyond a shadow of a doubt. She stuck her face, his face, on that memory. And he went to prison for 18 years until DNA evidence could get him out. And then he was out of prison for 2 more years before he gets accused of murder, and that's what the rest of the documentary is on. It's very interesting. But talking about the bias and how we deal with memory, and even what we read on the news or hear about an article will affect how we remember things. Bias creeps into memory without our knowledge. This is from the Stanford School of Law. Bias creeps into our memory without our knowledge, without our awareness. While confidence and accuracy are generally correlated, when misleading information is given, witness confidence is often higher for the information, incorrect information, than for the correct information. This leads many to question the competence of the average person to determine credible issues. Juries are fact finders, and credibility issues are to be determined by juries. The issue that arises is whether juries are equipped to make these determinations. Expert testimony may not be helpful. Indeed, since the very act of forming a memory creates distortion, how can anyone uncover the truth behind a person's statements? Perhaps it is the terrible truth that in many cases, we are simply not capable of determining what happened, yet are duty-bound to do so determine. Maybe this is why we are cling to the sanctity of the jury and the secrecy of jury findings. We can put such questions before the jury entirely without fear of embarrassment, because the way the jury resolves the question and, in all likelihood, the soundness of its answers will remain forever hidden. Perhaps the lure of the black box as a means towards apparent certainty in an uncertain world has tempted us to entrust the jury with more and harder questions than it has the power to answer. And I mentioned Stephen Avery, and I read a really good article on The New Yorker from it, and I wanted to finish out with this paragraph. It's very interesting. Toward the end of the series, Dean Strang, Stephen Avery's defense lawyer, notes that most of the problems in the criminal justice system stem from unwarranted certitude, and he calls a tragic lack of humility of everyone who participates. It is easy to express outrage, comforting to have closure, and satisfying to know all the answers. But a defense lawyer's remind people every day it is reasonable to doubt. So I hope today that you have a better understanding of what critical thinking and cognitive bias are, and why each and every one of us so desperately need to study them. Left to our own devices, what psychologists call the default mode of human thinking, we will be the subject to the flaws of perception and memory. So don't be so sure of yourself. Keep calm and remain uncertain.